This is the voice of the NASB, the National Association of Shortwave Broadcasters of the United States of America. The NASB is a non-governmental organization for privately owned shortwave stations in the United States. Currently, there are 18 member stations of the NASB, located from Maine to Hawaii and from Florida to Alaska, plus the South Pacific territories of Guam and Saipan. This program is broadcast each week to Europe in DRM, Digital Radio Mondiale, on Sundays at 1330 hours UTC on 9785 kHz via the facilities of VT Merlin Communications in Rampisham, England. The voice of the NASB also broadcasts to North America in analog mode on UTC Sunday at 0330 hours on 7385 kHz via WRMI in Miami, Florida. This series of broadcasts is currently running from October of 2003 through March of 2004. We would especially appreciate reception reports on these broadcasts from shortwave listeners in any part of the world. Reports mentioning the date, time, and frequency of the broadcast, along with some program details and an indication of reception quality in your area, will be confirmed with our NASB QSL card. Recordings are accepted for the DRM transmissions and would be much appreciated. Send your reception reports and program comments to Voice of the NASB, P.O. Box 526852, Miami, Florida, 33152, USA. That's the Voice of the NASB, P.O. Box 526852, Miami, Florida, 33152, USA. Or you can email reports to us at info@WRMI.net. That's info@WRMI.net. Each week we feature a different member station of NASB on this broadcast. And this week on the Voice of the NASB, we're featuring the newest member, I believe the newest associate member of the NASB, which is VT Merlin Communications. And we are here actually broadcasting or recording this program at the High Frequency Coordinating Committee Conference, HFCC Conference, in Dubai, in the United Arab Emirates. And we have three representatives from VT Merlin Communications with us here in our Dubai studios to tell us a little bit about Merlin and about what they do and about what's going on here in Dubai, in fact. Dennis Thompson, with Merlin, first of all, you're a member of the steering board of the HFCC. So why don't you tell us a little bit about what's going on here around us?
Well, here in Dubai, we are coordinating frequencies amongst the most of the major broadcasters in the world for the summer 2004 broadcasting season, which will come into being in the end of March.
And it goes on until, what, October of this year?
Yes, it runs until October, and then later in the year we'll be coordinating frequencies for the winter schedule.
Now, this is something that's really come about in the past 10 or 11 or 12 years, this coordination among all of the major international broadcasters in terms of frequencies, right?
Yes. Before 1990, in fact, before the Velvet Revolution, the Western major broadcasters had previously been coordinating together to avoid interference with one another. And not surprisingly, the major broadcasters in the Eastern Bloc had been doing something similar. And then in 1990, the Eastern Bloc were meeting in Pamporovo in Bulgaria, and they invited the Western broadcasters to join them. It was a tentative mix to begin with, but progressively in the 10 years between then and Dubai, it's grown into a very professionally run meeting. We meet twice a year.
How many years have you been involved in this process?
Since the early 1960s, when I joined the BBC schedule unit, planning their HF transmissions. And then I was fortunate enough to go to the first combined meeting in Bulgaria, and I've been attending regularly since then.
So here we have the English, the Americans, the Russians, the Chinese, people from Africa, the Arab countries. Everybody gets together and coordinates. It's kind of like a mini United Nations, huh?
Yes, the HFCC decided that they would merge with the Arab States Broadcasting Union, and so now we're a combined association, and we meet regularly twice every year. And then we have a sister organization, the Asian Broadcasting Union, HFC, and they meet separately many times, but then every 2 years we try to get together so we have a near-global coordination.
Now, specifically, what happens then? People come here, there are what, about 150, 135 people or so here from all of these organizations. They get together in a big ballroom here next door. And what happens?
Well, before we come to Dubai, we each submit our tentative schedules to the secretariat, the HFCC secretariat in Prague, and they combine them together in a tentative HF schedule. When we get to Dubai, we see the results of the combination, and there are one or two collisions where two or more broadcasters are using the same or adjacent frequencies to the same or adjacent target areas. So we then talk face-to-face and try to resolve these difficulties, these collisions, by moving one or other of the broadcasts to an alternative frequency.
And is everybody pretty cooperative about this?
Yes, it's surprising the degree of cooperation you get. And I think because we meet regularly and many of the people not only know one another but have become very good friends, then they exercise a great deal of give and take. And, you know, if we come to a solution and it doesn't work in practice, because we know one another well, we can take a step backwards and re-examine it. So gradually over the years, not so much when we started in Bulgaria, because it was very tentative, people didn't know one another. Now they do. They will trust, you know, and try things.
What about, I imagine, you know, there have to be countries in Africa and Latin America and Asia, various places who, for one reason or another, can't afford to or can't attend these meetings. They're not part of the coordination process then?
No, unfortunately they're not. We've tried to get them to attend so that, for example, last February we were in Sandton near Johannesburg when we had the AO3 conference, and we specifically invited some of the African nations because we thought it might be possible for them to attend. We did get one or two. For example, a colleague from Lesotho came. But unfortunately, as yet, the Latin American and the African broadcasters, with the exception of South Africa, don't attend regularly.
But most of the, as you said, most of the major broadcasters do attend. What percentage would you say of the world's HF coordination takes place here?
Oh, I would think something 80% plus. And in addition, although the other broadcasters in Africa and Latin America aren't here, we have information about their schedules. So in coordinating, we try to avoid a head-to-head with them, you know, because it wouldn't be sensible. So we can't resolve all the collisions yet, unfortunately, but we try to avoid the major big problems.
Now, at the end of each day, Dennis, all of this information goes into a central database, literally right next to this room we're in right now, which Vladislav Chip operates, and then spits out all kinds of information in various forms and formats about who's on what frequency when, and these collisions that you're talking about. And with this, then, people can figure out what their potential problems are and deal with the people that they have the problems with here at the conference, right?
Yeah. Each day we get a new version of the tentative schedule, And we also get a revised collision list, so we can see immediately the new collisions. Because, for example, it often happens that if there is a gap in the spectrum somewhere, one or more of us during the course of the previous day's business may find the same hole. So, you know, it's a constant rolling thing until we go away on Friday, and then even after Friday, up until the schedule comes into being, we set a deadline date some days before the start of the schedule, of course, we still try to resolve any difficulties that remain.
And this is some pretty sophisticated software they use for all of this, right?
Oh, yes. It's now, when we started, we really just determined collisions on the basis of geographic zones in the world. The ITU splits the world up into convenient zones, and we used to use those as a measure of whether there was a collision or not. But now we determine it by field strength, so it's become a much more accurate prediction of what is the real interference.
Also with us here from VT Merlin Communications is Richard Hurd. Richard, what's your title?
Hi, I'm Head of Transmission Services here at VT Merlin, and the responsibilities really are looking after the sales of airtime to broadcasters around the world using the transmission network that we've developed over the last 4 to 5 years.
Now, Merlin has both transmitter sites that it owns and operates and others that it leases or has some sort of agreement with. How many sites around the world?
There are approximately 35 sites, and they're broken down into 4 transmitter stations in the United Kingdom that Merlin own and operate, and then there are a number of transmitter sites that we operate on behalf of the BBC World Service around the world, and then we have a transmitter station here in the United Arab Emirates, which we lease off the Emirates government, and are able to sell spare capacity to international broadcasters. And then we have a number of partner stations that are basically operators from around the world who have strategically located sites that fill in holes in the network that we have. And when we run out of capacity, we look for new capacity elsewhere. So this is an ever-increasing target that we have.
We should explain, Richard, that this all basically began with the BBC transmitter sites that were sort of privatized, right?
That's correct. Back in 97, the British government decided to privatize the transmission side of the BBC. And that was both domestic broadcasting and also the international undertaken by the BBC World Service. There was an American organization that took on the domestic television and radio in the UK, and Merlin was formed by a management and employee buyout of the program delivery service, which was part of the BBC World Service at the time. And this became a private entity backed by the City of London, and that enabled Merlin to venture into the commercial world of transmission provision for broadcasters all over.
Now, you must be the largest provider of shortwave facilities for independent shortwave broadcasters worldwide, or not independent necessarily, but I mean, you have a lot of government broadcasters that use, besides the BBC, that use your facilities.
Yeah, that's correct. We've got over 40 clients now. These are broadcasters from all sorts of different walks of life. Obviously, there's the major state broadcasters who are looking to improve their transmissions and their coverage around the world. We then have religious broadcasters, all forms of religions, that are, again, looking to get their messages out around the world where previously they've not been able to reach. And then we have the commercial broadcasters and other types of broadcasters who, again, have specific requirements of reaching parts of the world with a clear, high-quality transmission.
Now, this part of the world is particularly interesting right now, I think, the Middle East for the past few years, right?
Yeah, that's correct, and not always for the best reasons, I guess. But we've set up a site here in the UAE The transmitter station is Dabaya, which was owned by the Emirates Media Corporation here in the UAE. And after sort of a number of years of broadcasting, they decided that they had other priorities in their life, and they offered the site to Merlin. And obviously, this was before 9/11 and the likes. And because the Middle East is a hole in our transmission network, we've previously covered from stations in Europe, in Russia, and elsewhere. But we looked at this. It's never a stable area, and there must be sort of capacity to fill this station. So we took the leap, and here we are, sort of 3 years on. The station is virtually full, especially at all peak times. We have, I think there's 14 or 15 different broadcasters transmitting from the site, and it is certainly one very big success story.
For better or worse, shortwave is, in a way, very much a crisis-driven medium.
Sadly, it is. At times, anyway. Certainly, there are times such as the Afghanistan crisis after 9/11, and then more recently the Iraqi war. And of course, during those times, the international broadcasters especially want to make themselves known and aware within the region. And obviously, yes, crises do drive some transmissions. However, one has to say that there are also broadcasters who have other motives of getting into the region, be that a religious purpose or a commercial purpose or any other. And of course, these people have been broadcasting here for sort of certainly since we've had the Dabaya station open. And of course, their transmissions are being heard all across the Middle East and Western Asia, where some of these more hotspots have been.
Now, Richard, you're in the business of selling shortwave airtime in an epoch when many people are saying that shortwave is dying and this is an outdated technology. But it seems there are no end of clients.
It's a constant thing that people say, sort of, shortwave is dying. And I would beg to disagree. It's not a dying medium. There are a number of broadcasters who don't have the options to use some of the more modern technologies of delivering their message. And one has to sort of turn it round to the audience out there. There are millions and millions of people on this world who don't have the ability to pick up and hook up to this new technology. One only needs to think of parts of Asia and parts of Africa and developing world in general, that satellite internet hasn't hit, and it certainly won't hit for a long, long time to come. And for them, the only way of getting free information of news, entertainment, health services, educational services, is shortwave radio. And that's the reason it is so important. And we do have a constant stream of people who are wanting to get on air, send their message out to the world for all sorts of reasons.
I don't know if it's any indication, but I went to one of the big shopping malls here in Dubai the other day, and to a store that sold a lot of electronic equipment, and about 90% of the radios they were selling had shortwave bands on them. Which is certainly not the case in my part of the world, in North America. Also here with us on this special edition of The Voice of the NASB today, coming from Dubai in the United Arab Emirates, is James Briggs from VT Merlin Communications, who is in many ways responsible for this broadcast. James, what do you do at Merlin?
Okay, I'm one of five people who work full-time on DRM, the new system that's going to be introduced over the next 10 years or so to replace all AM broadcasts. By AM, I mean long-wave, short-wave, and medium-wave frequencies.
And maybe we should explain how this program actually comes about every week here on... because some people are listening to this in our analog version from WRMI, and some people are listening to it in the DRM version from your facilities in Rampisham in the UK. In terms of the voice of the NASB, all of our member stations participate. This is a special edition of the program, but usually one of the members each week or associate member sends a program to us in Miami. We do the final production, putting on the introduction and the end of the program, the announcements, and then we convert this all into something called an MP3 program, basically condensing it into a small amount of space and feeding it via something called FTP over the internet from Miami to what does it go to, London or to Ramsham?
It actually goes to our control room, which is situated at Bush House. That's within the BBC World Service headquarters, and we run that facility. So it's sent via FTP to that facility, and then it's stored there until the appropriate moment that needs to be played out. And then it's played out over our satellite system to our transmitter site, and we receive it there and then retransmit it from our site at Ramsham, which is in the southwest of the UK.
Okay. Now, and then from Ramsham, it's directed to where?
Our main target area is Central Europe, so we're looking at Germany, Poland, Czech Republic, Sweden. So really, it's Central Europe, not so much France and Italy. It's a bit too far south to get the signal.
Now, that's really the key area for DRM right now, isn't it? I mean, Europe.
Yeah, Germany is definitely the hot spot now. I've run a project called the DRM Software Radio Project, and actually most people who are listening to this program on DRM will be using the software. And Germany is by far the leader in terms of sales. I've got some figures here, and I think it's about 60% of sales have gone to Germany.
And why is it?
It is a hotspot because, and there's probably already 15 transmitters transmitting DRM regularly on a daily basis in Germany, which is far more than any other country at the moment.
And in the Americas, there's very little DRM at this point.
Yeah, we'd certainly like a lot more. There's basically two broadcasts to the Americas, or two streams. There's one from Sackville in Canada, and they cover both the east and west coast at different times of the day. And that's owned and operated by Radio Canada International. Although there's lots of broadcasters on that stream. I mean, I think, for instance, there's Radio Sweden, Radio China International, and, of course, the BBC